Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
From WNYC, this is Money Talking. I'm Charlie Herman. This week, New York City Mayor Bill de Blasio took his show on the road and visited two of the nation's other centers of power and wealth, Washington, D.C. and Silicon Valley. He's pushing for a nationwide fight against income inequality. And he said in New York City, that includes
200,000 units of affordable housing over the next 10 years, enough for 500,000 people. An actual way to address the number one expense in the lives of New Yorkers.
But why should the whole nation care about the housing policies in this city? Well, economists looked at New York and two other cities, San Francisco and San Jose, and found that the laws that dictate how homes and apartments are built can not only hurt local residents, but hold back the entire U.S. economy. But some of those regulations are the very things that make those cities so desirable. Well, to explain are Heather Landy with Quartz and Annie Lowry with New York Magazine. And Annie, according to these economists, what would these cities need to do?
So the counterfactual that these economists ran, basically through their model, was to say that if San Francisco, San Jose, and New York had average restrictions on building, as opposed to the kind of tight restrictions that they have, how different would the economy look? And the answer is very different. So they started running this model way back in the late 1960s, and they basically said that by 2009, the entire economy would be 10% bigger, and these cities would be massively bigger if they didn't have the housing restrictions that they have currently.
Now, when you say housing restrictions, you're talking about how tall the buildings are or, you know, limits on the type of buildings that you can make.
Yeah, exactly. Limits on building in historically preserved neighborhoods, things like parking requirements, things like going through boards, all of the restrictions on building that you might have if you, you know, encounter them in your local neighborhood.
Well, Heather, it's a really interesting idea, but when you look at how productive those cities are and how successful they've been towards the economy, maybe there's something about the fact that those regulations have actually helped limit supply, limit people coming in there. Maybe it's a good thing.
Right. It certainly adds to the exclusivity factor, does well for property values because of basic supply and demand. And that makes these places an attractive investment for the people who buy in them. But I think the point of the research is that were people to give up a little bit on that, the overall productivity of the city and of the, in fact, the country, it appears, would be that much larger, and a rising tide would lift all boats.
Well, Annie, I think the likelihood that these cities would be able to overturn landmark protection laws or, you know, tear down Brooklyn brownstones or the Victorians in San Francisco is pretty unlikely. So what can we take away from the study in terms of figuring out how to grow these economies?
I would say that the takeaway is not that we need to reverse all of the limits that we have on building and basically create Soviet-style giant apartment buildings everywhere through cities like New York and San Francisco. It's just a reminder that there is a huge unrealized cost when we prevent building in our most productive and most desirable cities. And I think that in a lot of these cities, there's no reason that we can't do both, that we can't preserve historical character. And at the same time, say that when people are paying huge sums of money, when average families are paying huge sums of money in rent, that's actually not efficient for anybody.
One thing that I found really interesting in the research is the suggestion that one happy medium might be extending the grids of these high productivity cities so that other cities nearby could, so Oakland to San Francisco, for example, other cities nearby could be connected more easily to the grid and then be part of that sort of hub of productivity.
I guess that's the difficulty, is trying to find that balance between preserving the local interesting character and at the same time finding those housing policies that allow people to be able to afford to live in those cities and move into them, especially if they're not making the big, you know, Wall Street or Silicon Valley type salaries.
There's a tremendous amount of low-hanging fruit in allowing development in underserved areas and in loosening these restrictions, perhaps not in historically important neighborhoods, but elsewhere, and just allowing development in general.
Well, speaking of some of the things that we love to reflect on, like old buildings, this week, for some of us, we got to hear a blast from the past. OAOL, America Online. This week, Verizon bought the company for $4.4 billion. How the mighty have fallen. Annie, there have been a lot of explanations for why Verizon would want this tech giant of the 1990s, in particular its digital ad placement business. Why do you think Verizon bought it?
So I think that there are some assets in there that they are going to spin out for some money. So most notably the Huffington Post, which it looks like they're going to get about $1 billion for. So just go ahead and subtract that from the deal price, and already it's looking like a smaller deal. But ultimately, yeah, this was about ad sales. You know, what Verizon was buying was not all of the content, not all of the subscribers to AOL. It was really buying this ad back end. And so that, I think, explains the deal and explains the scope of the deal, which is, you know, it's fairly big for a company that's at this point basically a tech zombie.
Heather, what stands out to you about this deal?
Just the nostalgia that it's creating. I mean, I think back to 2000 when AOL announced its big merger with Time Warner. If I could tick off some stats, the difference between then and now for AOL, its market value today, $4.4 billion. That's what it was purchased at. In 2000, this was a company with a market value of more than $200 billion. It has about a quarter of the employees that it had back in 2000. Revenue, $2.5 billion versus $9.5 billion back in 2000, and on and on and on. But one thing that's actually really amazing from a nostalgia standpoint is this is a company that still has only a tenth of the dial-up subscribers that it had back then, but that still means there are 2.2 million people in this country subscribing to AOL dial-up, and I find that mind-boggling.
I guess what stands out to me is that when you look at the difference between 15 years ago and now, who would have thought that AOL would not be the leading service provider? It makes me think about some of the companies now like Google and Facebook. You know, where will they be 15 years from now? Right now, they seem so dominant, but that maybe that doesn't always last.
I feel like this is a testament to the fact that nothing lasts. They had a great business model that was enormously durable, despite the fact that at this point, there's really no reason for AOL to exist. And yet they're getting bought for $4.4 billion. It's a lot of money, actually.
Well, Heather Landy with Quartz and Annie Lowrey with New York Magazine, thanks so much for joining.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And I'm Charlie Herman, and this is Money Talking from WNYC.